So the first thing I'd like to do is say that the work I'm going to talk about is the work in progress of many people. And could those of you who are in my lab who are here raise your hands? So if you have questions, please feel free to talk to the members of my lab, and they will happily answer anything that I can't. So I think it's a good idea to start from the behavior itself, to try to make sure that we're mapping the neural circuits for the right things, and that the behaviors that we're testing are things that actually matter to the flock. So this is a video taken by Andrew Seeds, my postdoc at Genelia, who's got his own lab now in Puerto Rico, of a fly that we've experimentally covered in yellow dust by shaking it and then putting it in a dish under a camera and watching it grow. So we'll do this for a while, and you can see lots of features of the behavior just by watching it. It does symmetrical or in-phase movements with the legs to clean its head. It moves its head back and forth, and it will rub the legs together to knock the dust off. And each of these actions has rhythmicity to it. It can't pick up its front legs and its back legs at the same time. So at some point, it will declare its head clean enough and move on to cleaning its wings and its abdomen, again, with in-phase movements of the back legs and then third leg rubbing, also rhythmically and somewhat the reverse or the mirror image of the front leg rub repeated in the back leg.
How does the fly know that it's covered in dust?
What a good question. We have some ideas about that, but not all of them. We don't actually fully understand that. What we do is shake them. So they're smashed around in the chamber, and every one of the bristles all over their bodies get bent and deflected. And then the first thing they do is spot check everything. So probably it's a mechanosensory stimulus of wiggling all of their bristles around in a strange way. We think it's mechanosensory primarily.
Do they have blind spots? Are there parts of their body that they
yes. don't care about? Yes. Well, whether they don't care or they can't reach is a different issue. With this assay, the thoracic triangle, the notum, never gets really fully clean. So they possibly can't scratch the middles of the back. They do try, and there's a clear somatotopic map, because if you just wiggle one bristle, they move the nearest foot and sweep that one. So they definitely can sense that there is an insult and where it is, and coordinate a limb movement appropriately. There's a gorgeous set of experiments where they tweaked anterior bristles and noticed that front legs moved, and posterior bristles and noticed that third legs moved. And then there's a gray zone in the middle where it's a toss-up which leg will move. So there are lots of interesting additional experiments you could do trying to figure out if they start with the first leg, if they always use the first leg then, so if their map gets built and fixed. It's actually technically tricky to do those experiments. The dirty secret in the methods is every time you wiggle the bristle, there's a fairly low probability of response. So it's hard to replicate a lot of those experiments. And that was Neil's rotation project trying to repeat that. So I'm sure he would give you the miserable technical details. But there is a map. Clearly they're cleaning the dirt that's there, and they're not cleaning areas that aren't. The other thing that is important about this behavior is it's clearly an artificial thing we're doing to them, shaking them up with a powder we buy from Sigma. But each one of these movements resembles something that the fly will do spontaneously in our dishes and our vials. I do not know exactly what they do on our bananas. So I believe that this behavior represents something real for the animal, but the natural environment ethology is still pretty lacking on this for this behavior. Go ahead.
Sorry, You may have just said this before and I missed it. So if you shake the fly like that with no dust, plane, they do it for short time and stop, or?
Exactly. So the control is shaken but not stirred, shaken without dust. And the bashing around of all the bristles evokes a short bout of grooming that's not sustained because they're not detecting anything to repeat. Go ahead.
And is it fully non-adapting? In other words, if you preclude the legs from cleaning for a couple hours, they still clean?
We haven't done exactly that experiment, but if the dust is too humid and they cannot remove it, they eventually give up and wander off and do things even though they're dirty. So I believe that there is some, they stop doing the behavior. Whether they no longer sense it or they know it's ineffective, you can make them stop.
Do you think in the wild that they're more worried about things like dust or like mite eggs or other parasitic?
We can speculate on that. The abdomen is an area they clean fairly early on in the hierarchy, and that's a primary route for infections and pests. There's also a result from the Jan lab about wing kicking. If there's a mite on the wing, they actually kick and flick the wing to knock the mite off. That's a reasonable guess about why they would do this, but we don't know. They clean the eyes first, but they clean the eyes first in the dark, too. And blind flies clean their eyes first as well, which suggests that it's not visual occlusions that are annoying them. It's probably the omatidial bristles all over the eye. So we don't know why they groom. There's a little bit of data from old literature that they may groom differently in social contexts, but we haven't repeated that. All of our assays are single fly. And the times when Andy was initially screening in dishes with multiple flies, the biggest social effect was them bumping into each other and interrupting the sequence. So we don't have any evidence that they're doing it to look nice for their friends.
So it's a slight variation of Greg's question, but if you cut off the forelegs, would the hind legs stay forward and would they try to groom the eyes?
The hind legs don't reach the eyes very well, so I don't think so. We would like to be able to disrupt input stimulus versus ability to execute. So whether the inhibition of one behavior is at the sensory level or at the motor level. If you do the experiment you're talking about, if they picked up their hind legs, they'd pitch forward and whack their noses. So probably proprioceptive and balance cues prevent them from doing a full modification like that. So I'm not sorry to spend a lot of time on this behavior, because that's exactly what we're leaving.
So have you tried to just generate a big cloud of dust and get them covered without shaking them and banging them?
We played for a while with aerosol application of dust. We've tried a wide range of other kinds of dust. To get them to evoke the sustained behavior that we want to quantify the individual movements in order, we like to really pack them with the dust. We've actually been moving toward optogenetic activation as a way to make a more uniform mimic of the dust experience. We have not tried just walking them through clouds. I'd be interested if you have technical ideas for how to do that.
So they always carry yeast with them, right? So don't they clean off the food that they actually carry, or do they carry the yeast on the mid legs, which are not groomed, or?
They will groom their mid legs with sort of three-legged sweeping movements.
All right.
We do often see them cleaning their feet after they've walked across a dirty bile or something. So I don't know if they're deliberately carrying anything or if they habituate.
That's the dogma supposedly that they do, right? That they carry it and they inoculate. Yeah. But I mean, maybe.
Whether that's intentional or not, I don't know. They can clean cornstarch off, they can clean pollen. We've experimented with a bunch of different kinds of dust to see if they use the same strategy. Okay, so I got to slide 2. All right. So what's the process that we want to study and how do we want to do it? The first thing, we want to really characterize the fly behavior. We need an assay that we can do experiments with, but we want to make sure that that assay reflects something that the fly's nervous system is actually configured to do as normally as we can. Okay, so we have to characterize the behavior first. Then we want to know, how is the fly doing that? And what that means for me is trying to map the exact neural circuits that are required to perform this behavior, and then determine what the activity patterns within those neural circuits are when the behavior is being performed. We don't believe that there are many genes or many neurons whose exclusive role is making the fly groom. That would seem like a profligate waste of a small nervous system to dedicate genes to this or to dedicate specific neurons to it. It's more likely that sensory neurons and motor neurons act in particular combinations to allow the fly to groom, but that those neurons also have day jobs. Okay. Messier questions are, why does the fly do this? I'm actually interested in other people's ideas for how we can turn anthropomorphic speculations into testable experiments. Why would the fly groom in this way? Is, I believe, a reasonable and open question. And both that means, why do they need to get rid of the dust? Why don't they just happily carry yeast from place to place? And why do they do it in this kind of organized, anterior to posterior, probabilistic sequence rather than a fixed action pattern where each movement completely dictates the next? So you could ask the why question in several different ways. And also fairly important is, who cares? Why is this a problem that's particularly rich to study? And what would what I find about grooming apply to anyone else? So that seems like a very reasonable thing to have to explain your existence for. So I will try to do that in this talk.
Skip the evolution.
I'm going to put that under here. I think looking at some of the other Drosophilid species and perhaps other insects may give us some clues about why it's done the same way or differently in other creatures. That's a reasonable... You're speaking for Tinbergen, yes. Possibly I don't do that because I don't quite know how to turn it into an experiment, but it's certainly a reasonable way to view the problem. Go ahead, Claire.
Do you have like flies that would have obsessive compulsive disorder where they would just grow for no reason without any dust?
We are looking for that. And the other feature I would love to see is flies whose order of actions becomes more stereotyped. So in Andy's initial screen, he got one set of flies that when you inactivate a group of neurons and cover them in dusts, the flies get too clean. Do they groom more efficiently? Do they groom more? We don't know. That's worth revisiting. It was a terrible expression pattern, tons of neurons, figuring out why they did this. We haven't seen that a ton, but I would love to. Okay, so that's what I'm going to try to do. I already told you many of the features that we notice when we look at this behavior. But there are lots of different things you could identify and quantify, and you can do this as a human observer scoring the different movements or using a machine learning algorithm where we identify particular features of the movements that are diagnostic of different behaviors. All the flies do this kind of grooming and these movements without any training, which suggests that it's an innate behavior built into the capacity of the nervous system from the get-go. We're actually trying to do an experiment now with one of the undergraduates to repeatedly dust the same fly to see if it improves or gives up. So they don't require training to do this or learning. It's an innate behavior. The movements that we see in the experimental prep resemble the ones that we can get spontaneously. One action is performed at a time. They never normally pick up both sets of feet. So there is a mechanism for mutual exclusivity that's interesting to study. We can measure the transitions between anterior and posterior movements. And there are two different time scales that we can do that on. So in the anterior motif, where both behaviors use the front legs, there's a fast alternation between an out-of-phase leg rubbing and an in-phase head sweep. Then there's a slower transition between anterior behaviors and more posterior ones. They will do third leg rubbing or back leg rubbing and alternations with the abdomen and the wing or the thorax. So there are a couple of different time scales going on here and potentially different external or internal triggers that would govern these transitions. Okay, there is probably a somatotopic map because the fly will move its legs directly to the location of the dust. And I know the word modules is verboten, but someone will have to explain to me why. But there are clearly subroutines. You could dissect this behavior at a bunch of different levels. You could track each individual movement of the leg in a sweep. You could track leg sweeps. And you can also track anterior motifs. So there are a lot of different features of this behavior that you can quantify and try to understand how the nervous system controls them. For example, using Pavan's foot tracking software, we've been trying to figure out how they transition between an in-phase movement and an out-of-phase movement. So we speculate that this transition is gradual rather than discrete. So they start off with the feet basically moving together, meaning the head, and then they bring them down and alternate out of phase. So they can get here by just sort of sliding out of phase. But then when they want to initiate another head sweep, they have to synchronize their legs. So they actually, it's like a poker tell. We know they're about to do a head sweep because they yank their elbows all the way back and start again. So one transition is likely continuous and the other one is discrete. It's not a mirror imaged transition.
Really?
Yes.
Do females groom as well?
Yes, they do.
Better or worse than males?
Okay. How would you tell? Do they get cleaner? We haven't actually quantified that. We have some video of female flies grooming, and there is certainly reports in the literature that they have a post-oviposition grooming behavior that's a little different from the male. We have some data on this, but we haven't looked at it deeply. To a first approximation by an expert observer, the behaviors are very similar. Okay. You can also get different amplitudes of movements. They can do short leg rubs. They can do long leg rubs. When we increase the temperature, they do it a little faster. And there is a repeated cycle time for each of these movements. So for the anti-phase leg rubbing, it takes about 145 milliseconds to return to start. So this movement takes 145 milliseconds pretty reproducibly, which smacks of central pattern generator circuits. So that's the hypothesis at the moment, that once you trigger these behaviors with dust, then the execution of the motor program is a little set of clockwork wheels. That's the speculation. Yes?
So what is the y-axis here?
This is not the best plot that could ever be designed. This is early data. The y-axis is absolute position.
Relative to resting?
So we're tracking, we're videotaping, we're mapping the feet positions of the fly. We're trying to get it into body-centric coordinates. But all I wanted to show you here is that the peaks of the left foot and the right foot are out of phase in this part of the behavior, and then they're in phase in this part of the behavior. And if we had it in perfectly body-centric coordinates, these two should hit the same point. So this is a new direction for us, trying to track which neurons would alter the transitions between these two behaviors and potentially speed up or slow down the cycle time. It would also be interesting if the different time scales change together. So if we increase the temperature of the flies, they do everything faster. Does everything scale the same way, or does it scale differently? Do we speed up some behaviors more than others? And will that give us any insights into which circuits are actually coupled together and which ones are discretely controlled? So that's what we're interested in investigating for the short time scale movements. But the feature of grooming that makes it so cool is that it is a type of sequence. When you cover the fly in dust and it can't do everything at once, it does anterior behaviors first. So what we do is track with an ethogram or behavior record what the fly is doing over time as it removes the dust. And you'll notice that the orange and purple colors dominate the early time periods. So the first thing the fly does is clean its head, and the greens and the blues dominate the more posterior parts of the behavior. So if you squint at this, you will see there's more purple here and more green in the middle, but that no individual fly is doing exactly the same pattern. So it's not a fixed action pattern at all. It's a set of changing probabilities over time that result in this progression. Go ahead.
So morbidity will be distribution, the anterior-stationary in the sense.
It does appear to reach a steady state toward the end when most of the dust that can be removed is removed. Then they achieve stable probabilities of any given behavior.
You said you're doing experiments where you're dusting the same fly and observing it multiple times. Do you also see the same variability between just one individual fly?
To the first approximation, it is still variable. Quantifying exactly how variable, I'd like to think that there is some individuality and it gets slightly reduced, but I am certain that this fly won't groom exactly the same way the next time we dust it. So it's sort of a matter of effect size and how you quantify it.
So if you just apply dust to just the wing, let's say, or just the head, does it still groom all over, or does it?
Nope. It grooms the body part that's dirty.
Yeah, but it doesn't move over after.
Can it be just variance in the stimulus?
That's certainly one thing we think is probably true. So how would we test that? One of the things we're trying is making the stimulus more uniform by doing it with optogenetics. Do you think that makes it completely uniform? Expression levels of the optogenetics reagents, habituation, and it's better than dust, but it's not 100% uniform either. And then you're back in the same business of trying to measure whether you've made it a little bit less variable, which is where we are. Go ahead.
Could you apply a ring to a small nozzle with different parts of the ring?
Actually, that was one of the ways that people did bristle deflections, was blowing on them. I mean, you can grab tweezers and move them with an actuator, or you can blow on them. Would we cover the entire fly with wind, or would we use this to just target small regions?
Yeah, small regions then could be left. Oh, for all the entire fly.
Well, I think we know that some of the wind responses are just that they're going to hunker down and stay still. So I think about it. We haven't done that.
If there are mites crawling around, you could imagine that it would be advantageous not to have a fixed action pattern because the mites might learn to dodge.
You have preempted my Roomba slide.
Sorry.
I agree with you that having a probabilistic solution may have advantages. Okay. Yes.
Does the sequence or the variability depend at all on sort of other behavioral state variables, like how tired they are or other?
Not that we know know of. So this is a really dominant behavior. If you grab a fly that's young or old or interested in mating or not, or starved or not starved, and you shake them in a jar with dust, they're going to groom. It's a very overwhelming drive. So we haven't seen anything that is related to what they were doing before we harassed them. But it may be too subtle for us to have detected by any of the assays or any of the measurements we've made of the grooming sequence so far. There is a case with, I'm not going to show this data, but you can ask Lee about it. If you activate the bitter receptors, you can get them to groom. And if you activate them when they were walking, they tend to keep walking. But if you activate them when they were standing, they tend to groom. So there's a context dependence with some kinds of activation of grooming. Okay, go ahead.
Maybe you said this, I didn't hear. The shaking thing sounds really brutal. And what if you just like have dust rain down on top of them? Does it not stick to them very well?
They'll groom in response to that, but they'll be done very quickly.
Okay, it's a way to sort of prolong the behavior.
So that's actually how we know they'll restart at the head. So if you put, if they're halfway through grooming and you redust them, they go back to the head. And Andy used to call it the snow dome effect. You would just keep shaking dust over the top of them and they would come back. So, yes, we could do that. Okay, this is how we quantify what all grooming sequences have in common. If you take a large number of ethograms of grooming flies and you measure the probability that they will be doing an anterior behavior early on, it's high, and it comes down with time. Whereas the probability that any one of our 96 test example flies here will be doing a posterior behavior starts low and goes up with time, as does the probability that they will be walking. And then at some point, which differs from different flies, but we can line up the traces based on it, they reach a steady state where the probabilities of any given behavior don't change much anymore. So this is the way we quantify this anterior to posterior change in the probability of doing any given grooming action. Go ahead.
If it had been reversed, would they get as clean for a unit time? Is there something more effective or?
I don't know that. We might be able to model it. If you're cleaning your house, does it matter which room you do first if you spend the same amount of time in each room? Maybe.
Maybe they orient, say it's an airflow, maybe they are oriented a certain.
So they get the blow dryer and.
No, so that it's easy, it's better to first, say, normally would orient against the flow. I'm not sure how to do that. It would make sense to clean first the front part.
Well, that's what humans do in showers. Our assay does not have wind.
Okay.
So they may prefer to groom in line with the normal curvature of the bristles, but why they do anterior before posterior is a, they do it robustly, but it's speculation why. Go ahead.
So the anterior movements and walking probabilities seem like almost a reflection of each other.
No, they're allowed to stand still too, so these won't all add up exactly to one.
No, but does it even seem like.
So they can't walk and groom at the same time?
Of course. It's completely.
Not exactly. You can't take one curve off and predict the other one. Go ahead.
So, I mean, imagine that it's important to first see. So the first thing you want to do is clean your eyes. And maybe you could test that by keeping, passing them out in CO2. So then you cover them in dust. You clean their eyes and they wake up. Would they clean the front still? Or?
My prediction is yes, they will. The flies in the dark also groom their eyes first, and blind flies also groom their eyes first. So I don't think they require vision to do this. Whenever you knock a fly out with CO2 and let it wake up, the first thing it does is groom, whether it's been covered in dust or not. So it's hard to do that experiment. Ice does it too. Anytime they're recovering from something, grooming is the first thing they do. So it's tricky to do that experiment. Go ahead.
What's the meaning of these oscillations? Is it just noise, or, I mean...
They get smoother the more flies we add to it. And if we try to synchronize the point at which they reach steady state, then the curves will get a little smoother. So I don't think we should read too much into oscillations on this time scale. The oscillations matter when you're looking at the bout length for the anterior posterior behavior or the leg rubs, but this is a longer time scale. So I don't think we should infer too much from those wiggles. You can ask Josh, who's two seats over, and Prima's on the end, and they may give you a different opinion. But that's what I think. Go ahead. So,
well, for life blooming during a flight.
I didn't hear that at all.
So, well, for life bloom during a flight.
No.
So basically, they need to learn that to like, to the flock to begin.
Grooming is not an available behavior when they're flying.
I think so the middle leg needed to have some tension since I learned to share that grooming.
Just going to Theory's point there. I mean, I think that the head sweep might also have the antenna sweep. So even if it's dark, they're cleaning the mechanosensory. Particularly if you have things on the menstrual area, they really want to get it out. So I think it could still be sensory bias, right? They want to clean their sensory organs.
I definitely think they want to clean their eyes and their antenna. The eyes are loaded with intraomatidial bristles. And the antenna have cortotonals that are detecting being moved out of position in some way. Whether they do it because they want to be able to see better or smell better is the part that I resist. And Neil may possibly have done flies in the dark with no antenna. How much head cleaning did they do in that case? Flies in the dark with no antenna, so antenna clipped.
Yeah, I mean, they have the eye bristles, so maybe it's activated their eye bristles. They have tons of eye bristles.
There's a report in Crustaceans that they actually have better sensory acuity if their arista are clean. So that we haven't measured that.
And it's also data from cockroaches called the shawl. If they don't, I can't remember the details, but if they can't groom the antenna, the olfactory system deteriorates.
It's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis that the reason they're trying to get rid of the dust is so they can use their sensory organs better. We just haven't proved that.
So the argument that, you know, if you make them blind, it depends how you make them blind. I mean, if they develop blind, it's one thing. If you in the eyes or something else, it's a different thing.
The dark rearing is the best thing we can do. So that's a completely wild-type genetic fly in the dark. So it is not seeing anything.
It might be just an innate thing the first time.
Well, I think it's the 800 intraomatidial bristles. They're sensing the dust. And that is a strong cleaning response. We can't get them to change their priorities on the fly for any... So if you loom at them or make it likely that they will have to take off, they don't switch to wing grooming first. So we can't see any acute preference shifts in the speed. They start with front leg rubbing. And they will do this sort of lurch and flop. So it's possible that they're trying to clean a head they haven't got, but certainly they have dust on the front legs, and that drives.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead. What is known about the mapping of the somatosensory information to the brain or whatever, where it's actually sensed and how it's perceived? Can it be just inhibition at this level? If I sense the dust on the eyes, I don't sense the dust on the body?
We would love to know that. So a lot of the behaviors can be run from the ventral nerve cord alone. So a decapitated fly is perfectly capable of sensing the dust on a bristle and sweeping its leg to get there. So the sensory information from the body and the legs, maps to the ventral nerve cord, and the motor programs are located in the ventral nerve cord. So it absolutely can do that. The map is not in the brain for the bristles on the body. The map for the eyes comes into the SEZ. So the eye bristle neurons do come right into the brain. And the antenna cortotonals, we know where they go. So a lot of the map is in the brain, but how it's processed and then executed by the motor.
You understand what I mean?
The alignment of the sensory information and the motor information functionally happens, but where it is located is being mapped, but not yet known. Does anyone else want to say differently because they know more about this?
I mean, the Edo paper has projections from the body to the brain, so it probably is a bit of a map for the brain as well from the thoracic.
But the fact that you can do a coordinated and directed movement without your head means that the brain is not absolutely required for the reflex aspect.
But while the brain is tied up for the anterior posterior sequential, while the head is fly, we still show the kind of anterior posterior sequence.
Headless flies will also show an anterior front leg dominant behavior and then a progression to a posterior. Whether the sequence is exactly the same, the answer is no. But part of that is that they're missing this gigantic sensory draw of the head. So it would be nice to eliminate the descending inputs while leaving the sensory inputs alone. And I believe that the brain contributes to the organization of the sequence, but teasing out how much of it is just that it's a giant sensory target and how much of it is a control circuit is still being figured out how to do. David?
What is it that the bristles are actually sensing? Do we know how transduction of dirt, how does that become neural activity?
That is a good question. We can speculate. We certainly know that the deflection of a bristle opens mechanically gated ion channels. We have resident experts who will tell you in gory detail about that if you'd like. But the dust is light, right? So when I shake them, there's no doubt that we bend all the bristles and open all those channels. But when they're just dirty, what is it? Is it a difference in the deflection of the bristle? It's pretty light. It's pretty small deflection. The flies groom fine upside down, so it's not purely additive to gravity that's an issue. My guess is that when you sweep a clean bristle, you get a smooth sweep. And when you sweep a dirty bristle, you don't. So I speculate that it's the difference between the expectations of the sensory inputs. If you have a way to test it or a better hypothesis, I'm all ears.
So from this graph, at least, it seems like the bigger progression is between anterior motif and walking, and the posterior motif is it does increase obviously, but it increases less than the walking. And sort of a related question is whether you have looked at sort of the micro transitions, i.e., is anterior motif like a unit? If they do the hand rubbing, will they always do an eye sweep, or they can walk between two segments of anterior motor? And how it feels like from this graph that you have three motors, right? Anterior, posterior, walking.
Well, perhaps that's why people get huffy about modules, is that it's hard to define what the right subunits are. Certainly, you can only do grooming or walking with your legs at a given time. So just where the motor neurons are getting recruited is different. We could put this graph with standing on it too. That's just a postural recovery. We could put it with or without walking. I don't mind. We look at the transitions among all of them. We have transition diagrams and we're trying to analyze that. The short version is that you are not guaranteed to do a leg rub if you've done a head sweep, but the probability is enhanced. And you don't have to put your feet down between a head sweep and a leg rub, although you often will do this bout for a while and then sort of gradually pitch forward and plant. So it is possible that the maximum time you can do the entire anterior motif has some postural component. With the posterior behaviors, they'll do a body sheet, plant, and then rub. So there's a space between the posterior movements. But we have lots of transition diagrams to dig into for this. Dhananjay, you were up next. What?
So I think this came in the cognitive studies that there's leaky lymph coming out from the sensillae, the pores of the sensillae. So if you stop them from grooming, you see an accumulation of crusting of this lymph, which could explain the why question.
We have not looked. We have not seen that. I'm quite keen to keep talking about the behavior, but I can move on. There is other stuff we do. Okay. So I've told you about the wonderful phenomenon of this behavior, that it's a sensory-driven set of reflexes executed in a probabilistic order. There are lots of interesting questions. What parts of the nervous system control this thing, and what is the control architecture that would give you this kind of a sequence? When I first started this, I was completely wrong. I assumed that the fly would have a local cleaning response, my hands are dirty, I should wash that, and they would have a global evaluation saying, I have just fallen in the Tough Mudder mud pit and I need a shower. So if the dust threshold reached a certain amount, then they would switch to a completely different central top-down program. Wrong. We have no evidence that the fly does accumulation of it is really filthy and then executes this magic sequence from a central control. What we think is much more likely is that the grooming behavior that we call as an umbrella term of grooming is actually a whole bunch of local reflexes competing for who gets to drive the legs of the fly at any given time. So sensory information on one area drives this motor program, sensory information on this area drives that motor program, sensory information on this body area drives that motor program, and they can't all go on at once, so there must be some set of rules for who gets to go first, and whether that is that there are just more sensory neurons on one part so the drive is stronger, or whether there's weighted inhibition that just says this is better at suppressing that than vice versa, is the model that we're trying to test now. Okay.
So thinking along the CPG model, is there a role for peptides or neuromodulators in setting the balance of these different things?
We would love to think so. We have some preliminary evidence that dopamine has effects on enhancing the likelihood of posterior grooming. But whether that is boosting sensory gain and just making your back more sensitive, or whether that is acting to increase any of the inhibition. I mean, there are lots of places where it could act, and Sunanda is actually working on that, so you could ask her for the latest details on that. Yeah, I think peptides will modulate, I think amines will modulate, and I think we're going to have to be able to quantify subtle properties of the transitions to be able to see their effect.
If I understood the answer to the question of what they're sensing, part of being able to sense that these bristles are dirty is subsequent to the reflexive behavior, right? The way it's posited here, it's, you know, you get dusty and then you do the thing that cleans you. But in that earlier description, it was you do the thing that cleans you, you realize that it's not a smooth sensation, and so you keep feeling. Is there a role for active sensing of dirt that would precede this sort of sensory in order out? How do you think about that?
Well, if we have an undusted fly that's not doing anything else, it will sweep. So it's doing these spot checks fairly frequently. So figuring out exactly how they initiate a behavior may give us some clues about that. I would like to think they're actively checking, but we don't. Okay.
in your conception of this, are you thinking only of mechanosensory inputs, or could it also be chemosensory?
It's primarily mechanosensory inputs, but chemosensory inputs can add information to it. So we certainly expect the neural circuits to include sensory inputs, motor outputs, and then some layers of interneurons in between to do the processing. This is the whiteboard diagram of what we would expect per coming up with the kinds of circuits that would be there, and we're trying to find who they all are. One way to do this is to explore all of the reagents we have that target different types of sensory neurons or different motor neurons. So this is a candidate approach to looking for who can cause grooming or who can block grooming. So we're checking which ones of the sensory categories are able to evoke grooming when they're activated with optogenetics, or that are needed for the fly to groom in response to dust. And in general, the activation data is stronger than the blocking data. Likely these mechanosensory and other sensory apparati participate in other behaviors like coordinated walking and movement that may mask a more specific effect on grooming. So this data shows us that several different types of mechanosensory neurons, when activated optogenetically with crimson in an undusted fly, will evoke grooming. Several different classes. The mechanosensory bristle neurons are the big one. This is percent time grooming. In the control flies, they do some but not a lot. And now when we activate by turning the light on for a sustained period of time, the flies will groom more if you activate their mechanosensory bristles, their chordotonals, their campaniform scintilla, some on the stretch receptors. The hair plates don't do much, and the multidendritic pain neurons don't do much either. So several different categories of mechanosensory neurons will activate grooming behavior. Percent time, the exact ratio of head sweeps to leg rubs is different depending on which neurons you activate, and the exact sequence of the behavior depends also on the stimulus regime. But it appears mechanosensory neurons in an undusted fly, when activated, will induce grooming behavior. Okay, and I should also say Neil and Lee collected most of these data, so you should feel free to ask them any additional questions about it. When we activate visual neurons or when we put flies in the dark, we do not see effects on grooming, so we don't think they contribute. The olfactory activation and the olfactory orchid mutants don't groom differently, so we think odor is not key. And bitter taste, the GR33A activation, will evoke grooming behavior, so taste will do it. But if you eliminate GR33A in a dusted fly, they still groom fine. So they don't require the sensation of bitter. That's also consistent with the fact that lots of different dusts, which presumably taste different, all evoke grooming behavior. So taste can contribute, but is not absolutely required. And when Neil eliminates the interomatidial bristles, they groom their eyes much, much less. So that suggests that the eye bristles are required for the normal head-directed grooming behavior. So that's the best of the loss-of-function blocking data on the necessity for mechanical stimuli, at least in the eye. Okay. Activating all of the mechanosensory bristle neurons with light evokes grooming, lots of the different movements, but not exactly the same probabilistic sequence that we see when the flies are activated with dust. So this is our attempt to make the sensory stimuli more uniform, but the progression is not preserved in this. I think this is really cool. So what this means is that the fly has to be removing the dust, changing the mechanosensory stimuli to drive the progression. And when we just shine light everywhere all the time, there's no sense of progress. They don't change anything. So we don't recapitulate the normal behavior by dust you can't remove everywhere all the time.
It's really interesting.
Oh, good. I hoped people would fight about this.
So. I was going to say that it's really interesting that the walking is virtually eliminated. If you think about walking, I mean, it would be an effort to get away from the from the area that the assault has taken place. And, you know, counter to that, I was wondering if you've ever tried putting these guys in an arena and dusting them in a particular place and seeing if they have some memory of that location and they avoid that as they walk away.
I have a risky slide later on where we do something like that, but not quite. Go ahead.
So, did you do any physiology with mechanosensory receptors? Isn't it different game? Because light may work very different patterns.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Gee, we have some vocal collaborators who would like to arm twist maybe to help do that. Yeah, no, it's entirely possible that the stimulation we're applying with light doesn't mimic the way these neurons are going to fire in response to dust. One way is to just try a wide range of different optogenetic stimulation patterns, different frequencies, different intensities. It would be nice.
You shine the light all over the quad, so it's
We do that now. We're trying to target it. So the reason to do a lot of these experiments is to set up controlled sensory competitions with levels and ramps to test this idea.
But also the question is that there are probably some local correlation when you have a piece of dust between nearby vibrissa, but when you change the light, you eliminate everything simultaneously. That is very ambitious.
I would like to try increasing light spot sizes and see if we evoke the scratch response from a single and a more global grooming and sweep from a bigger one. Now, I think it's been said that when you have virtual reality control of the sensory inputs, you can design a lot of these experiments that would be very hard to do physically, but we use the way they respond to the dust as the inspiration for what to test once we have better control of the inputs. Jane?
Do you think this might be consistent with your picture of the simultaneous response of local reflexes? So if everybody's up, there's no dominant response to activate.
If everybody is activated, the intrinsic prioritization of anterior wins.
They usually do anterior
behaviors. So this is one of the lines of evidence I'd like to argue for weighted inhibition. So we're clearly above threshold to activate the posterior, and yet the anterior goes. So I think there are weighted inhibitions. Okay, so this is what we're doing to try to control better the inputs for mechanosensory to test some of these ideas for how the changing sensory stimuli drives the progression of the behavior. And this is actually a fine place for me to say that I don't work on navigation per se, but the circuits required to compute changes in sensory information over space or over time may match in grooming what you would have to do in navigation. So the circuit architecture that you would have to build to do fold change detection, differentials in space, differentials in time, may be shared. So, yes?
Sorry, just a practical question, because I don't know the imaging setup, but is it possible to set up an experiment where you condition the light on their own natural grooming? So they would groom, at which point you would turn on the light. I don't know if that's even possible.
If you had to wait for them to do spontaneous grooming, you would be old. So, older, yes. They don't do it enough that's, but we can control that they're going to groom with the light and then change what else we stimulate. So going toward closed loop is appealing, but we aren't there yet. Okay. So I told you that we're looking at obvious candidates like sensory neuron classes and motor neuron classes, and we're using the genetic tools to do that. But we also screen. And that's important to me because we don't always predict well which interneurons are going to matter to organize this behavior, and how changing neural activity in particular circuits could disrupt the behavior and subdivide it into modules we would not have guessed existed. So I like throwing wrenches into this system to see if the ways we break it are informative. Okay, and the classic example of this is the Vishaus and Nusslein-Volhard screens, where before they cloned any genes, they had a good understanding of the developmental units that pattern an embryo, and the pair rule ones were unexpected. Why would you do pairs of segments at a time? But the fact that you can mutate a gene and get a phenotype like that out suggests something about the underlying algorithm of this developmental process that was unexpected. So that's what we're hoping for grooming, that we'll find ways to break it that will tell us something about how the animal has organized it. Okay, practically, how do we do this? We have the UAS Gal4 system. We have a large collection of Gal4 and split Gal4 lines that can target very small numbers of neurons in the nervous system of the fly, and we can acutely turn those neurons on or off using light. The first set of screens we did used temperature. These were done by Andrew Seeds. We covered flies in dust and turned off subsets of neurons. We got flies that groomed fine. We got flies that were filthy. We got flies that could groom their head but nothing else, flies that could groom their wings but nothing else, and the wonderful flies that were too clean. So this showed us that the behavior was modular. Then we did activation screens, where we could turn on groups of neurons and evoke specific behaviors, such as antennal cleaning. We got sensory neurons out of these screens, and we got interneurons that have a command-like function. Activating them elicits the whole behavioral program. We did not get the motor neurons out of this behavior. We did not get some of the inhibitory interneurons that we have other evidence to suppose will probably be there from the connectivity data. So these approaches are effective at getting some kinds of the neurons that contribute to the circuits. What we're doing now is screening smaller subsets of neurons with the light activation and inhibition reagents. And we're trying to use patterns of activation and inhibition. Perhaps neurons, that the code in the neurons actually matters for which behaviors they evoke. So we may get neurons that have multiple abilities to command depending on who else they fire with or exactly what pattern they fire in. So we have better reagents for targeting, better reagents for controlling subsets or the activity patterns, and also better ways to quantify more subtle changes in behavior. So those are the screens that we're still doing now.
So if I understand correctly, so the assumption is one gene, one behavior, right? And
very rarely.
And I'm sorry?
That happens, but it's rare.
But effectively, we are knocking out some one gene, right? It's a mutational screen, right? So we're hitting one gene, right?
These are neurons, so subsets of neurons.
Okay, that's, I guess, what I was trying to understand. So one gene or one neuron. And sometimes one gene means one neuron, but not necessarily, right? So one gene...
Very rarely. Combinatorial gene expression codes give you identity of neurons.
Yes?
Or is there no gene knockout here?
This is activation of a subset of neurons using a small hunk of DNA that may or may not match the expression of the gene it was near originally.
Yes.
My only point here is sometimes we get lucky and a given neuron will have a very distinctive effect on this particular behavior. And we bias our ability to find that by covering them in dust so we know they're trying to groom when we're doing it. And we know we won't get everything because lots of the neurons that participate in grooming also have other jobs, and the exact combinations and firing patterns will matter. So this is only one way to get to some of the critical neurons. Still think it's a good thing to be doing, but I understand that it won't get everything. Okay. And this is my advertisement for why we should do this, because sometimes we get things that are way cooler than what we were looking for. Is the movie actually playing? Yes, okay. So in this case, we've activated a subset of neurons and driven the fly to do leg rubbing, but not head sweeps. So it's capable of doing the out-of-phase movements, but not the in-phase ones. So this was not in our search design. We were not looking particularly for this phenotype, but it is an interesting subset of neurons that control an aspect of the behavior that we now know we should be paying attention to, and we have a very sparse subset of neurons that are a foothold into understanding the left-right coordination between the neurons. So we scream so that the fly can tell us things that are important to it that we didn't already anthropomorphically designed. Go ahead.
Are you also looking for neurons that are active during particular phases?
So that's the other thing that I was going to say, is that we know when you interrupt a behavior that's controlled by a complicated interacting network of neurons, you won't get everything. So what are the alternatives? The alternatives are trying to identify neurons whose firing correlates with aspects of the behavior. So we're trying to set up Pavan's ventral nerve cord image separation so that we can watch subsets of neurons that we have some indication might be involved to see if their activity actually correlates with particular behavioral transitions. And the other thing that we can do is map by connectivity and anatomy. So some of the neurons that we identified as part of the antennal grooming circuit, we got not initially because of their behavioral consequences, which were subtle and hard to tease out, but because they were anatomically in very close proximity to neurons that we had identified in the functional screens. So while I am a strong advocate for the genetic screening approach, we'll also use everything else in the toolbox to try to get the rest of the players in these circuits. Okay. Briefly, why does the fly groom? There's a haiku about fly grooming that we've argued about the translation of.
With the transparency problem space causality, did you fix that? Sound looked interesting.
Do we want to go back to that one, or do we want to do that one in the coffee break?
No. Sorry.
Good slide.
Let me finish the brief things that I wanted to say. That's speculative, and so I think we can go back to it for those who are gluttons for punishment. Why does the fly groom? Perhaps it's asking us not to kill it by... Please? When we look at the Braidenberg vehicles, we learn that simple circuits can produce quite complicated behaviors, and that the movements of an animal or a machine suggest reasons. Are these robots truly in love with the light? It's a cautionary idea that we don't know why they groom. And so as we try to figure out what the pressures on this circuit are, we should be cautious. One of the undergraduates in my lab did an experiment to try to figure out whether the flies like to groom. So he had a quadrant light chamber, and he activated neurons that evoke grooming, either sensory neurons or interneurons. And he discovered that the flies spend more time hanging out in the light quadrants of the chamber. They walk around, they go in and out, but they stay in the light. If you activate bitter neurons, they get right out. If you activate sweet neurons, they stay. And if you totally immobilize them, they don't go anywhere. So perhaps the fly is choosing to be in the area where grooming is initiated. This is going to be a next goal.
If it gets in the grooming area, it just gets stuck there, right?
That's why we do the stabilization experiment. They do something different if they just get stuck there. We've watched them. If they stay in the light because they can't get out, they look like this. We know that they walk in and out. So we're trying to figure out whether it's just a locomotor bias. That's why we keep turning the chamber to make them walk from place to place. And we're trying to design I'm really cautious about how we're going to interpret this. But mice groom, and they will groom in a novel environment, and it's thought to be a self-soothing behavior. So it's considered a positive action for some creatures. And I would have thought the flies would run away from this, that makes them feel itchy. And I was surprised by this result. We're still trying to bulletproof it. But perhaps they groom for reasons that I would not have thought.
One way to address that conform would be to ask whether they come again and again. How many entries they make per unit time.
And if we can associate it with a neutral cue. We're trying to expand this. Go.
All right, is there an issue just keeping their spiracles clean? Is there...
We don't know that. Possibly.
Do they look like under respiratory distress still?
We spend a lot of time blocking spiracles, and the flies don't really care.
Trying to get there. Say again?
No, you just leave. You go to sleep. Fine.
Got it. Okay. Kathy, go ahead.
Primates will groom each other, right? It's a social behavior. Are there insects that will groom each other?
We've never seen it. It's called owl grooming. We've never seen it with flies. We don't know. Okay. So other Drosophilids, when we put them in our assay, will also groom. And they will also show an anterior dominance, and they will also show a non-fixed action pattern. This is the data that we have, and we're trying to interpret how we can use it to say what the advantages of grooming in this way might be. And this is more of a teaser to say I would like to talk to people further about what to do with this observation.
Can I ask, one species here would be elegans, which lives in flowers, and they're presumably always coated with pollen.
My initial thought was that the ones that had super niche restricted habitats would have stereotyped grooming patterns. But to first approximation eyeballing, we have not seen that. But now that we know that Drosophila melanogaster is also a specialist, perhaps it's not surprising. Mice groom too, and although their sequence in some of the literature has been listed as fairly stereotyped, if you actually look at the data, it's probabilistic in much the same way as fly grooming. So perhaps the algorithms that govern grooming in lots of creatures will be similar. So this is pure speculation, but the people who made Roomba do not have it sweep, 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 sweep. They have it go and bump, go and bump, go and bump. And that is slower, but will clean your house no matter what you've done to it. So perhaps flies have a more probabilistic, noisy, and energetically expensive grooming sequence because it allows them to cope with whatever dust they happen to run into today. It would be nice to be able to model this and show that it's true in silico, and it would be even nicer to try to figure out how to test whether the flies actually care about doing it this way. What I'm interested in is the small computational circuits that perform operations that are common to all brains, and that can be implemented in variable orders to give you a wide range of behaviors. So basic Lego bricks, basic neural circuits, can be used to do a lot of different things. And that is the level of analogy that I think our work can contribute to. Flies have nervous systems with complicated sets of connections, and they can do useful and fascinating behaviors with those neural circuits. And presumably, if we reduce to the right level to figure out how particular combinations of circuits perform calculations that we can test in the fly, we'll learn something about how all brains solve similar local problems and organize many more complicated kinds of sequences. So you could think about this as a why do we care slide, both for the subunits that we will be able to interrogate and for the global organizational schemes that we may be able to speak to. Okay. The basic synthesis of the approach we take is a genetic dissection of neural circuits with a respect for the behaviors that they control. And this is the progress that we've made on trying to identify neural circuits that allow the fly to groom in response to dust in a flexible order. I've been told that you understand the nervous system when the results of your experiments no longer surprise you and you can correctly predict things. We are not there yet. I hope we're going in the right direction. And if we are, it's because I have these people to thank. Thank you.
Since you were saying you would like to understand not just one species, but relatively generic mechanisms. So one possibility to go from one behavior to another one, I touched a little bit, is from dynamic system theory. You consider a behavior, periodic behavior as an attractor, and this attractor becomes unstable because of other time scales, and you go to another attractor and do another periodic behavior thing in another place.
I think that's actually something that we're trying to screen for, is not to break the behavior totally, but to shift it from one mode into another. It may be hard to get that with binary on-off. We may be better able to see that from the activity patterns.
Your experiments where you were photoactivating the bristles globally, and you said, and then you lose the sequence. Was that in constant illumination? So you're never, and you suppressed every, you sort of you had more of the anterior grooming, and that makes sense to me, right? Because they never get themselves clean. So if you, can you do it so that you then, you wait a while, then you turn off the head stuff, and you'll get a transition?
If you turn the lights off completely, then they have a memory that they've been previously activated in the posterior, and they will do some posterior grooming after that.
So I was thinking you turn it off sequentially, turn off the head, and then they'll do the tail, the abdomen.
I would predict that that will be the case, and that's why we want the focused targeted light rigs to be able to do exactly that experiment.
And conversely, if you just put them in a snowstorm of dust, you know, generally continually coming down, they keep working on the head, perhaps?
Yes, they do.
Exactly. Does it relate to the early question? Is that because of the number of bristles in the anterior are higher than the rest of the body? That gives you a natural weight.
We think so.
Yeah.
And we're trying to redistribute the bristles in a variety of different cool old school genetic ways.
It seems like when they're grooming, there's a delicate balancing problem too. They're shifting their center of gravity and they're lifting their legs up and so on. So when, I mean, do you find balancing problems when you screen for dirty mutants, and could those physical constraints be one of the determinants that sets why they do things in certain proper order.
So they do tend to use the middle legs posturally. We see that they prefer to stand on those. We do get dirty flies that are also clumsy. So exactly what's the cause and what's the effect there is unclear. If you screw up the weight-bearing proprioceptors, you would have bad balance and you would also be bad at grooming. So which thing is the cause is not always so clear. I'm happy to take any additional questions and show you the causality slide in the coffee break. Thank you very much.